I'm sort of embarrassed to admit that, as you know, when I was in seminary, and especially, I sort of vaguely knew these people were there, but knew nothing about them. I grew up in Annapolis, Maryland, and we had a Greek Orthodox church, and I knew that. And they always had a good softball team in the church league. You know, and I mean, it's sort of, but there was something right there about the kind of ethnic specificity that often marks Orthodox communities. I mean, as national churches, if you come from an area like Chicago or something, Serbian Orthodox, you know, and they're kind of different. But it's sort of like they went their way, and ours, and they, their holidays were different. Easter doesn't come at the same time. Christmas is a week later, and you know, and I was sort of curious about that. When I was in graduate school, I did a fair amount of work in early church history, what they call patristics in the Latin for the fathers, the theology of the fathers. And I learned a little more then. And it was that combination of having done some early church work and then teaching Reformation, and undoubtedly the fact that I'm a woman, for all these things come in for balancing the dialogue teams, there was an opening on the international Lutheran Orthodox dialogue. Now, there's also one here in the United States. And I was nominated for that position. And so suddenly, I got my first set of notes about a meeting, and it was in Crete, you know, and I thought, this is really different. I'm not going to Allentown, you know, or, and so it was that funny way of sort of thinking, oh, this is a, you know, a different part. And in some ways, just eye-opening, because so many of the assumptions that I sort of make when I talk to other Christians in this country just didn't fit. I don't want to mean like they aren't Christian, but I mean, the development of their tradition, the way they worship, and particularly the kind of social and political situations they were in, and the intertwining of their religious communities. Many of them, of course, have ended up behind what was the Iron Curtain. So that, for me, has been sort of a source of wonderment. And when I've talked about ecumenism and what would be the goals, what could we hope to accomplish, let me say that in many ways, the Orthodox dialogue is the one where it's the hardest to predict. It's probably going to be the slowest go. And there are times, let me say, and again, I speak for the international one, because I will say friends of mine who have been on the national one have found right away the fact that you share a culture makes a big difference. You know, the Orthodox in this country have to be, in some ways, every bit as, I mean, they have converts. Orthodoxy in many parts of the world, if you were born there, you were Orthodox. It's that simple. You know, 98% of Greece is nominally Greek Orthodox. But so that here, they face a kind of situation that gives us a lot of kinship. So that the national one, I think, has some openings. But the sense of just facing people who are really other, and at the same time realizing that you're not, it has been, because you're Christian, the commonness of the confession has been one of the most moving experiences of my ministry. It's also been one of the most frustrating. They can be very stubborn about, you know. And let me tell you another piece that really struck me is, Americans and Europeans to some extent, but particularly Americans, even if you look at the program here at Holden this week, there's quite a bit on communication. And we think that's important, and it is. I mean, and process that, when we're training students at the seminary, we say, you know, as much of your proclamation comes in how you say it as in what you say. You have to attend to group dynamics. I'm supposed to pay attention to whether you all look bored. You know, take seriously disagreement. How does the ebb and flow go? And one of the things that fascinated me is all the levels of this kind of rivalry. But process questions just aren't what they're about in some ways, you know. And it was to realize the very different kind of expectations as to how you would come into a meeting like this. For example, one of the first things, the official languages of the dialogue are English and German. And by and large, that is not the first language to any of the major, many of them speaking one or the other, but, and one of the reasons they did that was it was kind of a boundary setting, because they found that too often they sort of just fire off in Greek and they yell at each other, you know, and the Russians would just be, and that you had to do something kind of to sort of keep it so that everybody could stay involved. So just the way it works out was very different. Obviously, going as a Lutheran, Lutherans are rare. I mean, I don't know how many Lutherans there are in Greece, you know. When we were in Crete, we were in small villages. I remember we went to a liturgy that celebrated. Now, can you imagine? One of the festivals regularly celebrated were the sainted fathers of the Council of Nicaea. And this is 325 AD, defeated the Arians. We do not generally chant their praises. This is a vivid, I mean, not that, I mean, we take it, but I mean, this is a vivid part of their history. And the church was full, you know, and a lot of it was these villagers came to get a look at Luther. You know, I mean, that, now they're seeing a lot more of them because Crete is a cheap place for Scandinavians and Germans, but we at least weren't wearing bathing suits, so that made us different from most of them. They see there. All right, so that kind of hit me. That we were really, I mean, they what are these people?
Was this a new speech?
Oh, well, European, it's quite interesting. One of the things that struck me is a cultural clash. The Scandinavians and Germans would come down in these bathing suits that were really quite, I mean, they're astonishing. And many of the Greeks, especially Greek women, were all clothed in black and covered up. And it was just like these people, I kept thinking, do you think maybe this offends them? That you sort of, but it's like two different worlds just going on side by side here. So that piece was just very striking to me about the way the liturgy, the women sat separately. And for me, coming as an American, as a woman and an ordained woman, I'm a real anomaly. I mean, sometimes I think I got the position just to be a burr in their flesh, you know, in a way, as a reminder that this is part of what we do. But this is a place where I said earlier, this question of ecumenical relations, the pinch can come when we say, I will recognize my bond with you so closely that I will. There are certain decisions I will not make without consulting you and taking into consideration. Okay? See, so they feel that the fact that we just went ahead and started ordaining women pretty much said we didn't care that much about sort of ecumenical consideration and reciprocity, because there's no way they're going to do that. I mean, I think it's quite. And it's sort of, you know, I'm not used to people being that so. Well, it's. I don't think that it was like directly rude, but just to say, I mean, one of them said, well, what do you do? Well, probably the same thing that your parish priest, I mean, but how does that work? And realizing that the fact that I'm doing it in the United States, for some of them who are like from Romania or whatever, see, even to envision what my world of ministry looks like, and for me to envision what their world of ministry looks like, is a tremendous challenge. And very humble, very humble. The Russians who come, for example, think of it. The Russians come to these meetings. They bring their own interpreters. Now, this was before the changes in Russia, so the part of this was still. Now, if you think Lutherans are sort of theologically rigid, or very maybe the word is very careful and specific in their doctrine, Orthodox theology is very highly technical in many ways. I mean, so now you have official languages of German and English. So you have a translator who's not necessarily theologically trained, who's got to translate what may have been said in Greek, right, translated into English or German, and then he's got to translate it into Russian and come back with what, I mean, it's overwhelming in some ways for them to figure out what's going on. So, say that, some of this would be anecdotal to say, I feel a little bit, you know, it's like I got to go on a ride that took me into a place I just didn't have any idea. And the powerful thing about it, I have to say, is as strong as my disagreements have been at points, is the wonder of saying, when I pray, as we do weekly for the Holy Catholic Church throughout the world, the faces that come to my mind are faces I never knew were there. You know, this man is a monk. He's one of 13 children born to an impoverished family in Romania, you know, who is an assistant to the Bishop of Romania. I'll come. He's the one I see. And I remember at our last meeting him saying on the first day, I want to offer a prayer of thanksgiving for the people of the United States for what they have done for the children of Romania because of the number of adoptions in a time where what happened under Ceausescu is appalling. How children with any kinds of problems were treated and the church wasn't allowed to help. And the little bits that would come out, what it was like, our last, we had a meeting in Moscow in June and the coup was in August. And to go and see people being, I mean, openly worshiping in churches, I haven't been able to do this in years. Not in the central city. Now, as they said, in smaller parts where they didn't find it as politically threatening, there was always kind of a, you know, a quid pro quo with government and church about what they, but not where it would be really central and a statement. And I remember coming out of the service, one thing, they're quite long and they stand up. And it was very hot. And there was what they call a holy fool, something that I've only encountered in the novels of Dostoevsky. You know, a man who was matted hair, kind of wild-eyed, covered with small icons, you know, and people would come, he would just stay on his knees on the sidewalk, praying, and people would come and pay him and then kiss, he would offer the large cross he had for them to kiss, you know, and he'd just think, I mean, part of it is, you know, we're pretty sanitary. That just that kind of party, and as they say, this man would have been imprisoned or put away just months earlier. And so now, this church in Russia is facing a very great challenge. One of them is that to have preserved their liturgical practice and their kind of, it's a siege mentality. That's what's preserved them all these years. And now suddenly they're faced, as one of their church leaders put it to our group, we have lived in a spiritual wilderness for more than 40 years. And our people are very vulnerable. And so all sorts of groups are coming in now. Now, how will the Russian Orthodox Church respond? And they're being really torn because those who say the way we've preserved ourselves in the time of peril was precisely this kind of rigidity. And others are saying, that's not the way you're going to bring people in. That's not the way you're going to thrive. In a world where people don't know what all this ceremonial and all these restrictions mean. And so it was the first time in our ecumenical work that we really encountered some hostility, because a lot of some of the Russians in the seminary and everything, there's a real xenophobia, a real, they don't want strangers there. They don't think ecumenism is for their good. And others who argue it's precisely our connection with other Christians throughout the world that allowed us to survive. So the stakes are very high in this, in terms of our keeping in touch, just so that there are some windows open that, like I said yesterday, it is not easy to be free. And the combination for many Orthodox people in the eastern parts of Europe, such of a new political freedom, a new religious freedom, is quite threatening, actually, because they don't know how things are going to come out. For example, small Orthodox church in Poland, small Orthodox church in Czechoslovakia, both countries that are predominantly Roman Catholic, they're very scared of a kind of establishment of Roman Catholic and an actual persecution. Right? Last time we were there, the Orthodox have broken off their ecumenical relationships with Rome, and at the time the reason was that the Pope started sending persons to Russia, which he regarded, you see, as unchurched. And the Orthodox are there like, wait a minute, we've been here. And so it's a tense time in that regard. So in a way, these people who are perhaps the farthest away from us in some sense also represent in Europe a real frontier ecumenically, because the way these things are handled would say a lot about how these churches relate in the future. Lutheran presence in the Soviet Union, for example, how can that be upheld and yet respectful of a tradition that was deeply rooted and already there? So they're very interesting And I think the head of the ecumenical office in the ELCA, his name is Bill Rush. Of course, Bishop Kilstrom is the chief ecumenical officer. The last meeting we had, a team of persons from the ELCA headquarters had just finished one of the ecumenical, and it really was very moving when they talked about, particularly when they went to what the Orthodox will still call Constantinople, which of course is Istanbul, and what it was like to go there and see this. It's really a remnant. This was the heartland, the center of Orthodoxy. And it was, most of the Orthodox in the world have lived under domination. They either lived in conquered lands under Islamic rule, and then under communist rule in places. They are persons who for years and years have to have a siege mentality. And to remind yourself of that when you come to a ecumenical discussion, it's our ethos is quite different in this country. But they talked about how they went to a hospital. It's sort of like a nursing home and hospital combined. And this very old woman, probably, well, she said there's probably upwards of 90, who spoke no English, just held their hand. And when they translated for her, she had written a poem about what a joy it was for her to have other Christians come. Okay. American Lutheran Christians, in a pinch, you know. I mean, these are kin. And that they came away just, you know, because the government was moving to close that hospital, and they didn't know where these people would go. So I think that, in that sense, to pray for them, to remember these Christians who are far away, I mean, and they carry, in some sense, the oldest strain of our tradition. I mean, in the early centuries, we're one. These ecumenical councils, those of you may know something about, where the Council of Nicaea, the Council of Constantinople, the Council of Chalcedon, where the early chief doctrines about the Trinity, about the divinity of Christ, about the twofold nature of Christ, you know, these are the things that form the identity of Christianity, and they remain really the bedrock of Orthodox teaching. So I'll say that to give you some idea, but I mean, that it's both a kind of an academic interest, but perhaps in some ways they're the ones who have challenged me the most personally to think about what Christianity is like when it really looks very different. You know, there isn't even sort of a cultural commonality. And I tell you, when you've got to stand for a four-hour liturgy in a language where you don't understand a word, it does sort of strain your sense of being, you know, sort of open, hospitable. And they make you be up front, you know, and then they, like, come out with stools every once in a while because they can tell you're, like, flagging, which is sort of humiliating, you know, but it is different. And, of course, with the incense, the air is quite heavy. And it's like, what will happen if I pass out up here? You know, will they remove me from my position for having made a scene? And you just hope that your pantyhose don't have any runs and that you didn't wear laddered underwear so that your mother will say, well, at least you were prepared to have an accident, right? You're going to keel over here. So the polity issues, I want to look at a couple things with the Orthodox that I think distinguish them. One of the polity is a very important piece. For example, in the international dialogue, because of polity, there are no American Orthodox present. Yes? Oh, okay. Polity, fair enough. I'm sorry. And don't hesitate to, don't wait till the end of the quarter, like some of my students do. You know, you use this word. I mean, it's like political organization. So the way the community is organized, how authority is structured, and how it works. Right? So we talk about, you know, among Lutherans, they'll talk about, well, they have a congregational polity, meaning in some ways the major center of sort of decision-making and judgment lies in the congregation. Or they have an episcopal polity, it means it's the bishop. Okay? The Orthodox it's very interesting, they consider themselves an undivided church, but they are a communion in many ways. It's not like Rome with one head, but you have various, and they call them autocephalous, it means that they are sort of autonomous, they have their own head, but they are in communion with one another. So you have an ecumenical patriarch But you have the head of the Greek church, the head of the Russian church, and the point is that truth, in some sense, comes, you see, this is, it's conciliar. See, that's why for them those ecumenical councils are so critical. That when those, when the Council of Nicaea was called, the Emperor Constantine called all the bishops from the various churches, and it was through their joint work that the Holy Spirit acted. It, as it will say, it seems good to us and the Holy Spirit. Now, so there has to be sort of mutual recognition. I haven't been quite clear about what went wrong in the United States, but the indigenous Orthodox Church here, maybe for the Orthodox Church in America, this is the one that will have a liturgy in English, the OCA. And as I understand it, it was recognized by the Russian Orthodox Church because it sort of was born out of emigration from that group. But you see, the other Orthodox churches felt that they were not consulted and they don't recognize it. So the upshot of it is that in the international dialogue among the Orthodox representatives, there's no one from North America. And that's a real problem, I think. Right? Now, what's interesting is there are persons, Orthodox Christians, in this country who would be connected with the Armenian or the Greek or the whatever, see, and so they are answerable to a patriarch elsewhere, and when their representatives are chosen, they usually come from the homeland. But, so right there, this is like a thicket that I don't begin to get, you know, about why, but this is very important for their sense of how the church is organized, and let me say, for the Orthodox, their chief dialogue partner, as you can well imagine, is really Roman. Church. And they're starting, see, it's interesting, how did they come to be two separate things?
You mean before you go on?
Yes.
Do you think that the U.S. situation, or the North American situation, is a function of the multi-ethnicity and the fact that they didn't really talk to each other for ethnic reasons?
Well, I think actually, it probably, as I gather, it would be because the consultation amongst the heads of the various churches actually would have had to happen somewhere else. You know, it's not, and that because this was sort of like a child or an offshoot of the Russian church, they recognized it. It's not been clear to me that the other churches are really irritated with American OCA members, but that they're irritated with what the Russian church did on its own, breaking the bond. Do you see what I mean? It becomes a different issue, and it's sort of hard to figure out, and it is sometimes hard to get at, I find, ask them, well, exactly what is the problem? Okay, but I think it's not so much in this country itself where the Orthodox seem, I mean, I'm sure it varies according to how rigid one's ethnic identity is, but more and more, the Orthodox are no different than Lutherans. You know, Lutherans are not all Norwegians anymore, or all Germans, or all... It means that doesn't, and they're, all churches in this country are under a very interesting, I mean, what happens? The church in this country is what? It's a voluntary community of committed members. People choose to belong to a church. And the Orthodox, in some ways, could depend, as we often did in earlier generations, that if you were born into this community, you would automatically be in this church. But that's not the way it is anymore. And so in some sense, they have the same sort of concern about evangelism, about drawing people in. And it makes their situation in some ways very distinct, I think, from the Orthodox experience in other parts of the world.
Is there a fellowship among the Orthodox churches in this country? The Orthodox Church and the Greek Orthodox?
Yes. To be honest with you, I don't know. I think there must be something, because when they have the national dialogue, you see they come in those various groups. And they will, and they understand themselves as kin. As deep as their disagreements may appear to outsiders, they understand themselves as kin. Yeah. So that then this polity issue, then what, as historians look at it, basically what happens is when Constantine becomes the emperor, and this is in the 4th century, he then I think it's 312 is when he has his major military victories. The Council of Nicaea is 325. And what he's trying to do is get a unified, I mean, it's much like the Emperor Charles when I spoke of the situation in the Reformation. And Charles, of course, looked at Constantine as a good role model. Right? There was division about proper Christological doctrine in the realm. And we don't have to get into the Arian controversy, but was Jesus really divine, or was he sort of a in-between thing? And the Council of Nicaea was called to settle the issue to provide religious unity within the empire. Now, what happens is that Constantine moves his capital east to the city that, of course, takes his name, Constantinople. And at that time, the Roman Empire is a broad sweep, and it's sort of like you have a western and an eastern part. Now, what happens in succeeding generations are influxes of foreign peoples, I mean, what they call barbarians. Some of them were, and some of them weren't. I mean, as we think of barbarians, but they were all foreigners. Territory gets conquered, and little by little, what happens is the West and the East get separated. And in the West, when they are in danger or need, it becomes less and less likely that their appeals to the Eastern Emperor are going to get any response. And so the Bishop of Rome, in some sense, moves in to fill the vacuum. And that's one of the reasons that the Roman episcopal office rises up the way it does, because the Roman bishop is able to assume a certain, not only, he has to fill a political void. And we know then, fairly early on, that the Bishop of Rome starts entering into political diplomatic relations with some of these kings of the invading peoples.
Before which, that time, was the Pope in Constantinople?
Well, what happens is he's not a Pope. No. I say what you have are bishops or patriarchs, the heads of local churches as they see them. There's one in Rome, and there's one in Constantinople, and there's one in Alexandria, and there's...
But was there a Pope?
No. And this is the point where you have disagreement now. You can see that then the method of the episcopal office in their eyes is the sort of an elegant, divine means by which the church is ruled. But they each have a necessary piece, and the Holy Spirit works through the gathered, right, so that they are equals. Now, because of the unique position that the Roman bishop came to occupy, he was sort of recognized, they call it the primes inter pares, which means the first among equals. He was accorded a kind of position of honor. And for one of the reasons was because Rome was what? Rome was the place where Peter was alleged, and Paul were allegedly martyred. He had kind of a twofold claim to fame. But he was still understood in some ways to be one of the boys. What has then divided the Orthodox, one of the chief issues of debate between the Orthodox and the Romans, is this question of papal primacy and the kinds of claims to authority that the Roman bishop makes. Now, when you read Roman Catholic theology, it's quite clear that the Pope is understood, this comes in Vatican II, to exercise his authority, once again, in collegial relationship with the bishops, but he is above them. They must be in communion with him. And remember, the First Vatican Council in the latter part of the 19th century, I realize this is fairly recent, declared that the Pope was infallible in matters of teaching and morals when he spoke ex cathedra, which means from his throne, from his episcopal throne. This is very alarming to Protestants. It's just that he doesn't speak from his episcopal throne in that way. He's only done it once. See? I mean, but for the Orthodox, see, he couldn't make that kind of claim. Now, here's a place where they're at a real logjam. If they understand church sort of the big debates in the church and stuff should be properly settled by a council. Once the church is split, see, you can't have an ecumenical council. You can't have a universal council. So they don't look, for example, at like the Council of Trent, which was a response to the Reformation. All of this has no standing for them. We went into schism in the 11th century, not in the 16th. And we know that in the 11th century, there was a profound moment when they mutually excommunicated one another. Representatives from the papacy and representatives from the Patriarch in Constantinople. Theologians and historians have looked at this and said, in many ways, what happened was they were separated. They didn't have email. You know, they went there, and all of a sudden, when they met again, they just didn't know each other. It's sort of like the great sorrow that sometimes happens in marriages. You wake up one day and think, you know, gosh, we don't know each other. We think and do things differently. They fought over a number of things. You know, the dating of the holidays, how a calendar was figured, over the use of leavened and unleavened bread. But at heart, there is the piece that the traditions just sprung up differently. And the big place, where you feel this, is over who are the key theologians. One of the great historians, Yaroslav Pelikan, who teaches at Yale, has written too much to begin to name, but a five-volume set on the history of doctrine. He's an American, isn't it? Well, see, that's what's great about this country. You can have a name like Yaroslav Pelikan. You're an American and a Lutheran. But he comes from, he has all the languages, has studied orthodoxy as well. And in his five-volume history of doctrine, his second volume is on just look at it. Just when you look at a history of doctrine, look at the point at which you have to have separate volumes to talk about East and West. That you can't talk about the history of Christian doctrine in one piece anymore. And it comes early, volume two. But one of the things he has said in his history of Western or Latin Christian theology is that all of it could be written as footnotes to St. Augustine. And in some ways that is really true. St. Augustine was a North African. In the West, he's, let's say, around 400. When he dies, he is facing the onslaught of barbarians. Barbarians, who distinguishes, right? But one of my colleagues, David Moore, dude, it's so funny, said, I think the difference is the Vandals were a tribe. I thought, how did you know that? Vandals were a tribe, Goths were a kingdom. But what he experiences in his lifetime is what? The fall of Rome, and when he's dying, the threat to his own church. And here is one of the key churches of the early Christian community, and it falls quickly to Islamic invaders, within centuries after that. North Africa is no longer the cradle. So what do they have to explain to themselves, right? Is what does this mean for the power of the gospel if Rome has fallen? St. Augustine's theology, both politically and personally, reflects on sin, right? And the bondage of the human will, original sinfulness, predestination, and the fact that human free will can do nothing in matters of salvation. You look at all the major questions that haunt us from then on, and every one of them can be traced back to some of the conflicts that Augustine experienced. He was in the Donatist controversy, when priests who had surrendered the holy books under persecution, could they be restored? Could they celebrate a true sacrament anymore? This question has come up several times. Augustine is the first one to answer it, to put the weight, the grace of a sacrament in the working of God, not in the worth or merit of the priest. But this question of purity, works and grace, how do they balance? Now, St. Augustine has no influence in the East. He's not an Eastern father. And it is very striking, if you would describe our theology as footnotes to St. Augustine, to realize, of course we're different. Of course we're different. They will, some of the Orthodox representatives in our program will quite straightforwardly say, that's a problem, is St. Augustine. And particularly over the issue of free will. So if I were to hold up ecumenically some things, this issue of authority within the church over against us Lutherans, the importance of the episcopal office for them. That is not the same for us, but over against Rome, we share with them a critique of the primacy of the papacy and that the exclusive role given to the Bishop of Rome. Now, on this issue of free will and sin, I have brought with me, this is one confessional document from the Orthodox. One of the things that's difficult is they don't write documents like we do. They go by the conciliar decisions of the early centuries, the theology of the fathers, and the last one is Gregory Palamas in about the 14th century, who has that standing, and the scriptures. Here again, they are much like Rome when they speak of the holy tradition. They have much difficulty with that concept of sola scriptura. Scripture alone, sola scriptura. Now, remember, this is another important piece. They don't have we know the kind of problem we have with Rome because we went through this with them. These are people who didn't experience the Reformation. Right? That's not a part of their Christian history. And another interesting thing is, as 20th century persons, we're really influenced by the Enlightenment. They didn't have that either, not the way we did. They weren't Western Europeans who read Kant.
Enlightenment is a Renaissance?
Well, that's later. The Enlightenment is really coming in a period in, say, the late 17th into the 18th century. A great example of an Enlightenment person is Thomas Jefferson. The critique of reason, they're beginning to bring historical, critical questions to scriptures, to experience. It's just the marrow and sinew of how we think. And that's another piece that culturally we don't have in common. So one of the great struggles ecumenically is that most of the time we bring up as Lutherans, when we have doctrines like sola scriptura or whatever, see, we're really sort of talking to Roman Catholics at that time, at the time of the Reformation. And sort of to remind, I always feel with the Orthodox, like the Roman Catholics are the absent party in the conversation. You know, like, that's the triangle. They got problems with them, we got problems with them, and we both sort of talk through them to each other. And what it is to say, you know, we have to talk directly, which means a kind of an identity crisis for us and for them.
We should have a trialogue.
Maybe. Oh, wouldn't that be a wild room? Be a wild room. In fact, one of the meetings we had, they were going right from the Lutherans to their next round with the Roman Catholics, and the joke was they were just sort of sharpening their teeth on us. It sure felt like it, because they were ready. I mean, you know, you could tell what they were going to be talking about with the Roman Catholics because of what they wanted to hammer out with us. Because, see, in their view, we're a lot alike. We're kind of...
So they have the same team that dialogues with both?
Apparently, but you know the other thing that influences them is the cost. By the time they spent the money to get somebody out to the West, we were meeting in Venice. It was just as easy to let them go to the net, or many of the same. These are often very impoverished, too. Yeah, I'm sorry, you had a question.
You explained a little bit about how we can, how they think. If we come more toward trying to figure things out and reason and be critical thinkers,
well, I don't want to say they're without that, but the kinds of the historical critical sort of revolution in reading scripture is just, it is just different. I don't mean to make them out ignorant. They're not. These are people capable of science and technology. But however their history has unfolded, they don't have the same watersheds. Theologically, certainly living in Islamic countries, I mean, the Islamic people were far advanced over Western Europeans at earlier stages. But theologically, the place where it comes across the most, and to me this is a very interesting one, with our emphasis on the fallenness, the bondage to sin, and the concentration, I mean, this is very Augustinian about the will, that we are so perverted and turned from God, that without God's action we cannot be turned back. And think that how we labor under sort of a constant sense of our sinfulness, that if wrongly produce, can it can really give you a sense of futility. Now, Athanasius is sort of, to me, a counterpart to Augustine. Athanasius was a bishop of Alexandria. He was very active in this big Arian controversy. It's called, he was thrown out of the sea and came back, you know. He was in the West at points when he was exiled. He was also, this is so critical for the Orthodox, is the monastic tradition. See, I mean, for them, a big piece of what their life is about is missing in us because we don't have one. He wrote the biography of Saint Anthony, who was so sort of seen as the fountainhead of monastic tradition. So Athanasius was a monk as well. And I will never forget, my first course in graduate school was on Saint Augustine. And in the course of it, the professor started talking about the difference with the East. And he said, you know, Athanasius once wrote, as a key Eastern father, said, if the problem is that we sin, we can repent. The problem is that we die. And I remember my jaw just dropped. I mean, that is a different emphasis. It doesn't eliminate sin. But the kind of picture you get in my, say, certainly from Athanasius, I think this is representative of the Eastern theology I've heard my peers in these meetings articulate, is that the real problem that comes with human sinfulness is the threat of chaos and dissolution. That with disobedience, something enters into the creation of God that threatens to undo it. And so, when you talk to them, the role of the incarnation comes up. We were in a church in Germany one time. It had been a Roman Catholic cathedral in the Middle Ages. It was a part of North Germany that Reformed, so now it was Lutheran. Beautiful carved wooden crucifix. And one of them, you know, there was in their long black robes and their hats and their beards, and one of them leans over and says, what do you think, Jean? I said, well, it's quite beautiful. He says, yes, it was very beautiful. He said, the more interesting thing, in my church, what would be there is a picture of the resurrection. Now that says a lot. I probably learned more from that to think about than I did. Right? So the incarnation represents for them not just sort of a means by which Jesus gets here so we can get to the cross, which at its worst is sometimes the way it sounds. But rather, here is the point where divine reality enters into the creation, almost throws up a bulwark. The forces of dissolution and chaos and destruction can go no farther because God himself has taken human flesh. And so the incarnation for them is really a moment, a significant piece of what salvation is about. And the thing is, this is the piece about sin. Well, you could repent. The problem is that repenting helps, but it doesn't stop sort of the toxicity that has come into the whole of what God has done. And I think the place, to me, this theme gets carried on, and again, these are my impressions, but if one looks at worship in the Orthodox Church, you may know that they use icons, and you've seen it, there'll be some here, extraordinary art form. Very, there are rigid sort of rules about how an icon is to be produced, what it can portray. It is seen as a people who, we had the icon painters from one of the cathedrals in Minneapolis come to speak to our class, and it's a calling, and they talked about the prayers, the things they needed to do to prepare and to bless the work. A distinctive perspective. Look at icons. Lots of gold. And of course, for them, what they represent is a portrayal of the resurrection, of resurrected reality, of things made whole. And that, when you think of going into an Orthodox worship space, some of you were here when I told that love, this has been such a wonderful anecdote for me. Here's the difference, not just theology, it's also aesthetics. When I first worshipped in those places, between all the stuff on the walls and the people, I mean, rich brocades, and I mean, their vestments are breathtaking. Whenever we went to a liturgy, all of them came out with hat boxes. It just sort of cracked. It was just such a reversal, you know, because and they brought them with them. And one of the real hospitality things offered was when you celebrated in a cathedral somewhere else, is that they let you wear their vestments. And all the people came because they would see these patriarchs or these bishops from different parts of the world. And it represented, you see, for them, a real una santa. Here is the church made one. Here is realized in part what will someday be wholly true. So, and then it was quite splendid. And the as the liturgy moves through, the icons become, see, for us, that we come out of a tradition that was fierce against images. The Calvinist tradition even more so. So, well, this is idolatry. This does not bode well. And they can't, for them, the icon becomes like a mirror. It is not the thing itself, but all, it's like a window into the divine reality, a connection with the saint or with the Blessed Mother or whomever. And the some of the, see now, if we had big fights over predestination, for example, one of the defining theological battles in Orthodoxy has been icons. The Second Council of Nicaea in 787, which you see for us, not one of the councils, just because by then we've sort of gone a different way. I mean, Westerners were involved in it, but they weren't, it didn't impinge on them in the same way. They had, one emperor had removed all the icons from the cathedrals. And then the Empress Irene came in and replaced them. And there's an annual celebration of the day of the restoration of the icons. Here's a defining piece of who they are that we don't have at all. And for them, the Christological argument, the argument about who Christ is, it goes back to this. If he is truly human, then one should be able to portray him. And others say, because you can't portray the divine, you can only portray the human, and that's bad. You know, so this was the argument behind it. But to have it in every family, will have a place, icons. The priest who came and spoke to us said that his family icon, when his wife became pregnant with their next child, that they took it back to the icon makers to fix it and add the patron saint of this child. So what you have then in this space full of all this beauty is for them all the splendor of the resurrected life, and that to go through the liturgy and receive the supper is actually, you see, it is a realization of the kingdom come. Yes?
You know, I'm sitting here struggling with thinking about what that's all like, and then thinking about the lives of these people who live in so much poverty in their non-religious life, and trying to figure out how they have an evangelical message to people who've been deprived of a religion, when there's this stark contrast between their religious splendor and the sort of starkness of their everyday lives.
Let me say, in village churches, of course, I don't want you to think that everything is sort of studded with diamonds and loaded with brocade, but I mean, there will be still lovely paintings representative of, you know, the arts and work of that locale. And I think this is a really good question. It comes also with Roman Catholic tradition, where they don't have icons, but they do have images, and they make offerings to them. You know, sometimes they will. I remember my mother coming home from a wedding and saying, "The bride threw her bouquet at the Virgin Mary. What does that mean?" You know. And I think this is a place, too, where our sensitivity to understand a kind of, I mean, lives that are our heart. See, they enter into this world. I mean, they come into this worship, whether the space is, you know, really elegant and rich, or whether it's rather simple with the arts, but it represents this fullness of being that will be theirs. And I think that what they give up to have that to them is, they wouldn't, I think they don't ask, wouldn't maybe look at it the way we do. It, you know what it reminds me of is this ointment could have been sold to feed the poor. You know, like that. And yet this gesture, this moment of beauty It is a transcendent moment. If I talked about Luther's concern about in corvatus in se, I think a piece for them is that this really transcends. The liturgy, some of the beauty of it is just in the elaboration of the way it's done. I mean, it's not necessarily that it all has to be brocade. And for high liturgies in the cathedral, it would be. But there's something about all the perfection of it. You realize that emphasis on the resurrection is something I think is quite distinctive. And of course, for those of us who are looking for a theology that can speak more to the peril of the world, this vision of evil or sin coming in and threatening everything so that our part in it, you know, the fact of our sins just getting forgiven is part of it, but it's not the whole picture, I think is quite a fruitful one, really. Yeah, let me stop there for comments. Yeah.
Is the picture that they have one of, you know, through the icon provides a window into the divine reality that will be, or that currently is, I mean, so that it's more of a realized
thing? Oh, yes, I think it is realized. I mean, in much the way we talk about, you know, we think of the Eucharist as a foretaste of the feast to come. Well, but it's the feast. I mean, you know, it's both, and so what it is, I think it's the question of transience, you know, that it really, the reality is right here and now, and it's not just sort of a preview, but it's not permanent, yeah. And part of it is, this also is quite a theology of transformation. See, that not only how the icon, sort of, transforms reality, the difference in perspective, the kind of the way you walk into this place and are caught up in these portrayals. But then as a worshiper, as you begin the process, come through up until the point that you receive the supper, so you too are being transformed. And that says something about the life you will have in the world. The importance of worship, I can't say enough. I just don't think you begin to understand Orthodoxy if you don't worship. I mean, we could sit there and talk about theology all the time, but somehow or other, the weight of who they are was there.
And the way they worship, you mean? They worship in their church?
Yes, their liturgies, yeah.
So have you ever been to an Eastern Orthodox Easter service?
No, I have not actually been to a vigil, but I do know persons who have, and say it is quite astounding. Have you?
No, but I read about, I mean, they have been to the Cuban one, and I was so fascinated by their explanation of how they celebrate Easter, which is not on the same Sunday we celebrate Easter.
No, that's right. Their calendar is different on that. One of the most fascinating things, when we were at those first meetings in Crete, they enthroned a new abbot in the monastery that was right by the... And we were all invited to that. And that was really extraordinary. As was... And we were there while they celebrated a funeral, and that was another one. The coffin just was leaned up against the wall of the church. You know, and then they all carried him up the hill and buried him. But the... The hours of prayer. It really was. I say the monastic presence is a very important piece of how this community carries on. Yeah.
So I'm curious as to how the Eastern Orthodox Church functions with the Islam in those countries where they are side by side, and how they're influencing one another.
My sense is it's quite bitter. That they feel very threatened, that Islam is not particularly tolerant.
So do they ever have dialogue? Do they ever
that, I don't know whether they have it there. I think one of the things is it's very hard because of the political fear. You know, one of the other places, precisely, of all the group to do so much portrayal, Islam, of course, one of the basic premises of Islam is not portraying. Right? So when they took over, they went to many places and gouged out the eyes on Orthodox paintings, because see, they think that that's sacrilege to portray human figures. If you look at Islamic decoration, it's not figures. See, they take very strictly the idolatry, the prohibition of idolatry. So I'm generalizing. I think this may depend from country to country. People I've talked to who are Orthodox Christians in Turkey, it's miserable. They're very nervous. It's clearly the case in Africa. All Christians in Africa, in Islamic-dominated countries, are nervous. And one of the things that was very eye-opening for me, I was at the last LWF assembly in Curitiba, Brazil, and we talked about interfaith dialogue. And one of the Lutheran representatives from, I forget which country in Africa, from Ghana, a large Muslim, and he said, they have now excluded Christian children from the schools. There is no Christian left in any position of authority in the government, you know, right around the place. Said, it is very easy for you to look at us and talk about dialogue. And we want to know, what will you do to help us if it comes to blood? And, you know, I think this is a place, there is a peculiar thing, but you know, you can be a Western prig or oppressor just in your sort of expectation of tolerance. It's not, look at Yugoslavia, Roman Catholics, Muslims, and Orthodox. And obviously, dialogue hasn't worked well there, see? So I don't mean that to fault them. I'm saying I think this is a place where ecumenically trying to understand a history that carries centuries of bitterness that we as Americans cannot imagine. I mean, look at, yes, the guy who did Matins this morning has to remind people about Hiroshima, because there are probably people in that room who either don't have a vague idea of our sense of history. These are people who remember injuries from the 12th century. You know, and it's very politically and socially very tied up with religion. So
I remember it, but they agonize.
So I only offer that to say, I suppose in some communities it's better than others, but at least outside looking at the world today, it doesn't give me a lot of confidence that dialogue has been too helpful.
So is there any dialogue here in North America between North American Islam?
There is between Christians. I don't know whether it's specific to Orthodox. There is a Christian Islam dialogue, and I think there is one internationally as well. I'll tell you another place which really come up is in Lebanon, the Orthodox Christians in Lebanon. Sometimes the extremity of these people who want peace, it has helped. And there's a Christian Buddhist dialogue.
And who represents Christian when you have these?
That's a good. That's a good question. I am not. I know somebody who's on it, but I don't quite know. I would imagine, wouldn't you, that those things arise because people are interested. You know, it's a Christian who has an interest in Buddhism, and then you begin to make connections and talk to people. You couldn't go into something like that without having some significant knowledge of the tradition and appreciation for it. But how they're officially constituted, maybe somebody knows more about this. It would seem to me the World Council of Churches might be a place that would be able to put together a team that was representative. So that's what I say, it's ecumenism, when you think of it, it really, and then it happens on many levels, but the local realities, in some sense, are the most important ones. Persons recognizing what are the stumbling points in their communities, and they face this with greater urgency in different places. And the encouragement of them to do that, I think, is really important. You know, because we may meet on an international level, and we tried to involve in Yugoslavia, we couldn't make something happen. And in fact, our representative from there can't get out anymore. So. Any other questions or comments? How many of you have ever been to an Orthodox service?
Listen,
go, because they are very clear that you're not welcome to the Eucharist. I mean, part of that is Orthodox is the right way. It is that community that holds these practices and teachings, but they're very hospitable. So that if you went, You want to look around. I think it would be, and I think you would really enjoy it. And I don't mean, you know, just as white, but I think that sense of, it would be quite eye-opening in some ways.